I do hope you will have an interesting lecture, but it's all depends upon circumstances and how interested you are, as well as my being able to express fully all that I feel. I certainly feel that this subject about which I am speaking today is of vital importance to the world, because the world is now going through a tremendous period of upheaval and changes, and it is in a condition of a discovery of a new way of life. And unless there is this discovery which is for the good, unless this is the result of a great appreciation and understanding of the values of life, I do not see how the many problems of the world can ever be solved. And it so happens that we never seem to solve the world problems, because we seem to be always marching on from one crisis to the other. And actually, a war is the culmination of a great crisis. And the greatest crisis of all is not merely political, it's not merely racial, but the crisis which is the crisis of character. Because that is the crisis that exists in the world. If character was right, if the human heart was right, there would not be this great crisis. And all this finally culminates into major events in the world, such as war. And unfortunately, we seem to have to even need these great crises, because we do not seem to learn the lessons of life by our own inner searching. We don't learn the lessons of life by our own thinking and our own research and our own discovery as to the values of life. It's events, it's all that happens in our lives, and our personal problems, our personal and national as well as international difficulties, that make us think. And certainly the advantages of so much suffering is the fact that we start to think. But I only wish we could think without having all these miserable experiences of life. But there it is, that seems to be an expression of evolution, and we have to evolve. And so all these upheavals, whether they are political or whether they are upheavals as a result of even natural calamities that happen in the world, and also upheavals even in our own individual lives, what happens to each one of us individually, these upheavals certainly lead us to a search, and a search for reality, and a search for truth, and a trying to find a solution to all the great problems. In reality, there can be no solution which can be offered by anyone else in the world. The solution has to be discovered by each individual. The solution is in the heart of each individual. It is only when the human character is right, when the human thinking is right, is it possible to have the kind of a nation, the kind of a world that we really want to have. Of course, we cannot say what kind of a world we want to have. I suppose we all have our ideas of what the world ought to be, or what our countries ought to be. Although we may have parliaments, we may have politics, individually we are all politicians, because we all make comments on what politicians ought to do, what governments ought to do. The one and only trouble is that when we are in the situation of having to do something, then we do not know what to do. It's much easier to know what somebody else ought to do than what we ought to do. The only thing we ought to do is to think, is to try to feel, is try to discover and think selflessly and think clearly. This is what we have to do. And this we have to do in the midst of so many varieties of experiences in the world that are taking place. Now, as a result of many, many problems that have arisen in the world, certainly one of the major things that we have to find out is what is the West and what is the East. Actually, we ought to be in a position to say what is the message of each, and yet to be able to say there is no East or West, but there is only one world and one life, which is the conclusion which we must come to by our own experiences. But today, we are at a particular period, a peak period in life, by which we have to discover what is in each, because as long as there is what we might call the psychological or political or any other cleavage or separation, this definitely is the beginning of a greater separation, which will be of a great revolution in our lives and will lead the world to a crisis, and which will be an unfortunate crisis as well. And that is what we are beginning to feel, or perhaps we are beginning to see changes that are taking place by which we shall discover the true values, both according to the East and also according to the West. The politicians in the world have become much more conscious of the East than ever before, because so much of what has been happening in the West, the concentration of events in the West, which may focused the attention of the world only to the West, has now gradually changed. And so the attention of the world is gradually being focused in other parts of the world itself. There was a time when we used to say that all the troubles in the world came only from the West, if you know what I mean. Because so many wars, the world wars, have had their beginnings in the West. So many racial difficulties have always been between the East and the West. And if there is a racial difficulty between the East and the West, it has never been a racial difficulty on the part of the East. It has always been on the part of the West. I am talking quite impersonally and giving you another viewpoint that may not have been thought of before. And one of the things which unfortunately has led to great crises in the world are due to the very things which ought to promote understanding rather than separation. There are certain forces which you find which are meant to be for the good. And there have arisen new forces also which are for the good. If I may say, the first, from time immemorial, the greatest force which has been for the good has been for religion. And yet, religion itself, which has played a major part in the lives of the people, have not played the part that it should have played, because unfortunately, even in religion, there have been barriers and there have been separation and there have been sense of superiority and so on. It looks as if the world is suffering from two types of complexes, either the inferiority complex or the superiority complex. And it seems to be suffering from this. I suppose, if I may say so, in my own judgment, on the whole, because the Eastern nations have so far been for some long time under the influence of Western thought, Western politics, and Western way of thinking and culture and so on, and even religion, because of that, and because they have emerged from it, and they are beginning to see the contrast between themselves and the West. So many Eastern countries have now come on to their own. They have discovered their own freedom. And each country is trying to assert itself. Today is the day of freedom. Today is the day of self-assertion, both on the part of a nation and on the part of the individual. This is what you see everywhere. But in Eastern countries, there has been a particular process which is quite different from Western countries. Now, in the middle, if I may say, there is India. First of all, we have to ask the question, what is East and what is West? As far as you are concerned in New Zealand, I do not know what you would consider yourselves. Are you Eastern or are you Western? I think gradually, as time goes on, you are becoming Eastern. You are Western in culture, Western in civilization, Western in heredity, but actually you are in a position by which the contact with the East will become more and more important. That is how I think. I am neither an astrologer nor a prophet. I am only thinking with you. And yet these civilizations are growing, and we have to see. And on the other hand, you may think that this country is Western, but in reality you are far away. The other day someone was saying, I am not English, I am a New Zealander, he said. Therefore he gave me the picture that he has divorced himself psychologically from his background, that he is starting a new life and therefore a new world and a new culture and a new message, which we have yet to see, because at present it is only in the stage of formation, in the stage of growth and so on. And therefore, it is impossible to say from that point of view, and yet it is of vital importance, even though your country may be very far away physically, we have to be psychologically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually close, and to be aware of the happenings for humanity, because the time has come by which we cannot live separately, we cannot think separately, we have to think in terms of the world rather than in terms of a nation. But that doesn't mean there is no building of the individuality of the nation, because it's only through that individuality, it is only through the individual genius of the nation, it is possible for the world to come together. It can never come together by being exactly alike, by leveling down. That is unfortunately what is happening in the minds of those who feel that a new expression must be given to the underdog, that a new life and a new opportunity must be given. I believe in that. But at the same time, we have to remember, in order to do that, we should not level down, but we should level up in all ways. This is a thought which we must keep in mind. That is only incidentally. But now coming to India. Well, India has played a very remarkable part historically and in every way between the East and the West. India has been a center of attraction both to the Eastern world and to the Western world. Why? Because fundamentally of her great past, her great philosophy, her great teaching, and her great spiritual message. And also, not only because of the spiritual and the character wealth of the nation, strangely enough, there was also at a time material wealth. And both the material wealth and the spiritual wealth attracted nations. Now this is very interesting to see historically, because if you go to China, if you go to Indochina, if you go to the Southeast Asia, Burma, Tibet, and all these countries, Thailand, Cambodia, and so on, all these countries have been influenced by the spiritual message of India. Buddhism, which went from India, has had its influence on China, Japan, and Southeast Asia, and Tibet. Hinduism also has had its great influence, because you can see, especially in Southeast Asia, the culture is a mixture of Hindu and Buddhist. This you find in the sculptures, in the temples, in the dance, in the stories, and it is a remarkable expression of the great power and the influence that India had over all these countries. And the Sanskrit culture seems to have spread far and wide into Afghanistan, even some part of Russia and Lithuania. This, you see, is the influence that India has had. And even today, if you go to Indonesia, when they do their dances, when they do their stories come from the ancient books of the Mahabharata, the stories of the Ramayana. Irrespective of what religion a person belongs to, because later on, Islam went into these countries. And you find in Indonesia, Mohammedans. But Mohammedans with a Hindu culture. Mohammedans with a background of Hindu philosophy by which there is a new integrated and a new expression which you will call typically Southeast Asia. And you see the influence in all these countries. And when I was in Japan, I went to see the temple in a place called Nara. And there were the wonderful statues of the Buddha, the wonderful statue of Kuan Yin, and they traced it back, the first Kuan Yin that came from Korea, and how it came to Korea, how it came with the Buddhist conception, and how the Buddhist conception came from Hinduism and from the great goddess of mercy. Now this is the influence that India seems to have had, and all these nations have come to India for those riches. Now the West also came to India. The Islam came to India, the Mohammedans, many, many hordes of people from many nations came to India, but it looked as if, although there are exceptions, like Pythagoras and one or two great teachers who have taken the great philosophy of India, yet they came to India more for the material wealth rather than for the spiritual wealth. And so, because of that, gradually the Western domination over the East grew. And because of that particular domination, in the whole of the East has undergone an extraordinary change. Now the East did not want that domination, and they have arisen out of it. But now, having arisen out of it, they have undergone also a psychological change. Now, I do not know whether all Indians and Eastern people will agree with me, but my own opinion is that today, because of that psychological change, what has happened in the East is, the East is physically free, but not yet spiritually free. Because their own faith in their spiritual message, in the gifts that they have to give, in the genius which they have to develop and to express, their own faith has undergone a change. And therefore, what I feel is that the East everywhere is getting more and more westernized. When I say westernized, I mean westernized from a purely materialistic point of view. And surely I feel that has prevented and is preventing, certainly I say, India from giving the true message which she has yet to give. Unless each country gives its own message, and the message is not by domination, is not by conversion, it is only a message which is to illumine the minds and the hearts of the people. And same, as far as the West is concerned, its influence has been along a different line. Its religion, for example, Christianity. Of course, Christianity, I suppose, cannot really be called a Western religion. And yet it has become, because it has spread over the Western nations. Christianity has played a great part in the changing of the mentality and the outlook of the East. And it's a great question which we have to ask, though we all believe in the teachings of the Christ, whether the Christianity as it has been given has really contributed to the welfare of the Eastern world is a great question which we all have to think over and which we all have to answer. On the other hand, the philosophy of the East, the teachings of the East, based upon certain fundamental principles, they are slowly filtering into the minds of the West, because the West is beginning to think and to question. There was a time when it accepted beliefs, but now it is not accepting because it is said. It is accepting because it wants to understand, and it must appeal both to the mind and to the heart and to its senses. And it is because of this change which is taking place in the Western mind, you will find a greater approach to the real East, real message of the East. And the East has a great message to give. And we have to discover what they are and whether the two have given to each other. Certainly, politicians might be becoming world conscious. But politicians, on the one hand, create war. On the other hand, they try to sign pre-peace treaties. To me, politicians are complete contradictions. I do not understand them, though I am called a politician, I am not one. But still, they are. Because you see, simultaneously, it is due to them that so many troubles happen in the world, and it is due to the fact that there is a sense of power, there is a sense of superiority, there is a sense of wishing to dominate. All these comes from the individuals in a nation who have those very weaknesses or qualities which gradually gets represented by the leaders of the nation. So we have to remember, when we speak about politicians, really the politics of the country is really what we are. And if we change, politics will change. If we think differently, politicians will have to think differently. And therefore, a great deal of politics is really representation of ourselves. It's always been said, you have the leaders that you deserve. And that is absolutely true, and we have to realize. But it has not been able to solve the problem, because unfortunately they are so much dependent upon the desire for power and the need to keep their power over the world. In India today too, if there is a difference, say for example there is the trouble between Pakistan and India. Why is there this trouble? The other day someone asked me. We know historically that for a long time all this has grown, not because of a religious difference, because there are Mohammedans in the rest of India with whom there is no trouble. It is entirely because of a political difference, but using religion as an excuse for that political difference. And it is a sad thing that religion has had a background of so much, not only politics, but so much bloodshed, while in reality, every religion came into being in order to give the message of brotherhood, in order to give the message of understanding, in order to give a spiritual message to the world. But unfortunately, the human individual is a strange individual. He may worship the Christ, but he will not want to live like the Christ. He would rather that the Christ lived like himself. And this is how we can say it with regard to every religion upon earth. Because we cannot be big enough. And when the Christ says, give the teaching to the world, perhaps we think, we are going to save the world. We are going to solve all the problems of the world. And if everybody becomes a Christian, then there may become a unity. And in fact, if you look at the last war, it was in the Christian world that the greatest war was fought. And the greatest cruelties existed. So therefore, that is not going to change. Because Christianity is not going to save the world, only Christianity will change the world. So is it with regard to any other religion, whether it is Buddhism or Hinduism, it applies to each one. And I know that every nation and every follower of every religion has what I might call a blind spot. And there are blind spots not only in religious prejudices, but unfortunately, now especially, you begin to see race prejudices. I cannot understand why there should be race prejudice at all. I cannot understand why we should think in terms of superiority and inferiority only on the basis of color. And it is remarkable that people do have this sense of color. And at the same time, we are thankful that the world today is thinking, is beginning to realize. And there are many movements, there are many expressions by which they are trying to change these things. That is the silver lining to the cloud which we are beginning to see. And sometimes we have done much harm. Sometimes, you know, we think we are very civilized people and we like to civilize other people. The great question which I think we should all ask is, are we really civilized? Well, only a short time ago, the most uncivilized war took place. Surely we cannot say the world is civilized. What humanity can do when there is mass emotion, when there is mass stirring up, we cannot tell. In times of peace, individually, there is always something which is great, which is beautiful within the heart of every single individual. But at the same time, we cannot tell what our minds will do when we are under the influence of mass energy and mass ideas that are put before people. Look at in many people today in Germany say, we don't understand why we accepted, why we allowed these things to happen. Some of the wonderful people, one can't be prejudiced against them because perhaps we would be exactly the same in their position. These are the things which we cannot judge, but we must understand. But these things do happen, and the seeds of war are sown in our own hearts by our prejudices. And we have these blind spots. You take in America. Americans, in my opinion, are friendly people with no prejudices at all. And yet, when it comes to certain portion, they may not dislike Africans in Africa, but when it comes to the Negro problem, you can see what it is happening, what is happening there. Now, it's no use judging America, because we have to see what is happening in our own countries too. And certainly, when I speak of these countries, I also think of India. I know there are people who cannot see and perceive certain things because they cannot be outside themselves. There are many people in the world who say it is a great thing that India became free from the British. And of course, one of the great miracles that has happened is the fact that India, after so many years of bitter fighting against the British, have ended up as friends of the British, and there seems to be no bitterness at all between the two. Well, that is the miracle for which we must congratulate both the Indian and the British. But there are others who say, when it comes to other countries, they say it was right for India to be free from the domination of the British, but not so right for other countries to be free from the domination of the other white races, because they are different. I know one Frenchman, he said about Syria, he says the Syrian people want us to rule them. In Cambodia, they don't want the French people to leave Cambodia at all, they said, because they love the French, not like Indians who had that feeling. But yet, now they are free, I don't see the love as much as I see in India. These are the blind spots we suffer, and we suffered from the same thing. And so we have to think honestly and sincerely and courageously and look at ourselves and our nation. The third great force is of great importance to the world and a tremendous power to the world. That is the scientific development of the world. You might say the greatest contribution of the West to the mentality of the world is the scientific contribution. But the great question is, what kind of science? What is science going to do? Is science going to bring the East and the West together? Is it going to create a new world and give a new message? And what is the new message that science is going to give? Science is going to tell you what the universe looks like. Science is going to tell you how you can go to Mars. Science is going to tell you how you can go to Venus. Science may give you the knowledge of nature. But can science change your heart? That's the question we have to ask. And unless that question is answered, we cannot positively say that the world is on the verge of a new understanding and a new life. We cannot say that science will change the hearts of people, because imagine today, after the great scientific discovery of the hydrogen bomb, the scientists have discovered their hydrogen bombs. What has it produced? It has produced fear. Fear has one advantage. Out of fear, there has been the postponement or perhaps lack of war. But it has produced fear. And surely fear is the real cause, ultimately the real cause of war. Why has it produced fear? Because side by side with the science, there has never been a transcendence of other material things. And as long as the value upon material things, and as long as the value of material welfare and material pleasures and the desire for power along materialistic lines exists, then science will always be a great danger. It will always be a danger to the world, not because science is a danger, but because the character of man is a danger, and he cannot cope with the great forces of science. One of the great teachers in India said, the scientists have discovered everything about the world, but the scientist has not discovered anything about himself. And that is the fundamental difference between the basic Eastern approach and the basic Western approach. The basic Eastern thought is the science of the self, the understanding of yourself, the appreciation of the values of life. Don't think when I say this, therefore every Indian is a perfect example of this. Because India and the rest of the East, as I have said, is undergoing a great change. It is becoming materialistic rather than spiritual in its outlook. It is overpowered by the dynamic force of the West. It is overpowered by the dynamic influences of ideologies, of science, and of the organization and the capacity of the Western life. And therefore, they are giving value more and more to the material rather than to the spiritual, which is its real message. But all the same, you cannot forget, because basically the Eastern teaching is the teaching of the understanding of the individual and what he is, why he is, what he is moving towards. And also the emphasis on laying stress upon spiritual values rather than of material values. And surely I think we can all say that in the world there is greater and greater appreciation and enjoyment of material values. And the extraordinary thing about material values is that when you have it, you are not as happy as you think you would be. It is strange, because I find so many people say, oh, what is wrong with us is we have too much money. In certain countries they say, in America they say, we are too comfortable, we have too much ease, we have too much money. And Now, having got everything we want, we don't know what more to want. And when you go to India or some countries, they don't have enough. So they need the physical, plain necessities of life, a better standard of living, a better way of living. So there is discontent on the part of those who don't have, and there is discontent on the part of those who have. And of the two, I prefer the discontent of those who don't have. Because those who do not have got the urge and a better appreciation of values. Because somehow or other, our senses become stunted, our senses become dulled by too much of material wealth, and even more, too much of the love of material wealth. Because in reality, there is nothing wrong in material wealth. Because according to ancient Indian teaching, they say, it is not the fact that you are rich that it matters. What matters is, first, the love that you have for the wealth. And second, the lack of understanding of its value. There is a wonderful story in one of our great epics called the Mahabharata. These are the real Indian approach. The true idea of detachment. That wonderful story is of a great king called Janaka. I may have mentioned this before, but I don't remember, so I will say it again. A great king called Janaka. He was one of the richest of kings, a great king and a great sage. There was also a hermit, a great sage who had a disciple. This hermit lived in the forest, who taught the disciple all the philosophies that he knew. And he said to him, I have taught you everything. So now you go to this great king Janaka and learn from him further. This disciple said, I have studied under the most spiritual teacher on earth. What do I have to learn from a mere king? Because the ancient India, they gave more emphasis to spiritual learning than to wealth or position. And so he said, a mere king. And what does he have? He has money. He has jewels. He has wealth. And that's all. What is that compared to the spiritual knowledge which you have given me? The teacher said, you may choose. So he went, because his teacher asked him. He went to this great king, and he was welcomed by the great king. And he lived in the palace. For days nothing happened. And after some time, when they were elsewhere, they heard that the palace was on fire. And the disciple, who had only two loincloths, was so unhappy, he ran to the palace to rescue the small possessions that he had. And when he saw Janaka, the great king, and somebody said to him, O king, your palace is on fire. The king said, nothing of mine is on fire. And so then the disciple realized, now I know what I have to learn. The king with all his possessions did not possess them. The disciple with very little possession, he possessed them. So it is that sense of possessiveness from which we have to be released. And that is the real detachment. Because in the true philosophy of life, detachment is not merely not wishing for this or that or the other, but a greater attachment to things of value, to things of eternal importance. This is the real message. These are the great truths which have to blossom forth from the East. Unfortunately, today they seem to be torn by political dissensions, and I hope a time will come when they will discover that these great wars and this desire for power, this desire for position and domination is not what is our true genius. And the West too must try to discover what there is of value in the great thoughts of the East. Actually, if you examine carefully both East and West, you discover that the East knows far more about the West. It has a far better knowledge of Eastern, Western literature, far better knowledge of Western languages and many other things, but not necessarily of all the things that are of value. But in the East, West has very little knowledge. And by the number of questions that people ask me about India, if I were to ask someone, who is the Christ, you will think, this Indian is the most ignorant person upon earth. And I assure you, if I may say so respectfully, there are many in the West who ask, millions of people almost in the West, who ask such a basic question as that when it comes to the East. And that itself shows the tremendous ignorance that it exists. And now I feel the time has come when this ignorance must be removed, when we have to discover the great gifts that have to be given. One great force that will help to give those gifts, that will try to remove the limitations of the mind, that will remove prejudices, that will remove barriers, is the force that is gradually emerging. That force is the great movement for the development of the true culture and the understanding of the essential culture of each nation. India had forgotten more or less her culture, or rather it was sleeping, not dead. And now it is beginning to awaken. And you can see it today, even politicians are beginning to realize that one of the great ways of making peace and bringing understanding is through the message of art and through the message of culture. When Russia wanted to express her friendship or the desire for friendship with America, or America to Russia, they sent their greatest artists as ambassadors, as spiritual ambassadors, because it's only by appreciating the great culture, which is not merely art, which is also the culture of the mind and the emotions, that you will begin to know the nation. And culture and art brings a certain influence which clears the ground, which makes possible better understanding, which produces what they use now in political language, which produces a climate for better understanding. And this is the great force, because art, fortunately, has been above politics, above religion, above all differences. To the artist, what race, what language, what country, what religion a person belongs to does not matter. It is only what a nation creates, what an individual creates. It is all that matters. And you find this, I feel that this is like the silver lining to the cloud, that it is the beginning of a new light, because we begin to see this approach, which has never been before. And strangely enough, when the British were in India, when great artists and great art really lived, except when it comes to archaeology, they did not see it, they did not know it, they did not appreciate it, though it was next door to them. But now, because those nations are free, you find more and more desire to come to understand it. Indian artists just went to Edinburgh for a great festival. Indian artists have been to many great festivals in the West, and they have begun to realize, is it a fact that India has such a great background in art, such great music, such great dancing and drama and so on? It is a new discovery. But it's not merely a discovery of art, but it is a discovery of the soul of the nation. And that is what it is gradually leading to. I hope, though, no artist will ever become a politician. And no artist will become an instrument for politicians. Because if art is subservient to a certain domination from the mind of others, then an artist is not free. And if he is not free, he cannot be creative. And he cannot give the true expression to the divine force which comes in the form of art. That, I believe, is one of the greatest forces now which will bring nations together. Not by unifying and saying we'll all be exactly alike. I know in India, for example, there were one or two people who think that Indian music, which is mainly melodic, must try to borrow something from the West and we must orchestrate it. Then it became a conglomeration. It was neither East nor West. And by copying so much of the West in the wrong way, it only becomes a kind of a mongrel civilization. Nor can the others copy. Each one has to express his own genius. Although I can never say that a great genius, if he is born, cannot do something different. But we cannot artificially and from a theoretical point of view do these things. These are the things which we have to remember. And surely a time is coming and must come when there is an awakening in the minds of the people, not only to the political freedom of Eastern nations, but ultimately to the spiritual background and the spiritual thought which is of eternal value to all human life. And that is the only force that is going to bring the world together and will produce a new world, and not only that, produce a new world, but a change of heart. Without a change of heart, humanity is not going to solve its problems. So we have to study this question, because really, if you start thinking what the East has to give, what the West has to give, the West has great art, great people, great messengers have come and gone. But what it lacks, if I may say, is humility. There, as I have said from the beginning, there has to be the desire to learn, to understand, to appreciate, and to help nations to discover themselves rather than to copy. And the same thing of the East. The East is now in a kind of process, I can say in India is going through a process by which she has to rediscover herself. Not that we want to again live exactly as in the past, because though there was so much that is great, so much that is of value, we cannot say that everything is suitable for modern times. But the fundamental teachings, the fundamental philosophy, the spiritual approach, the tolerance towards all religions, the appreciation of the minds and hearts of others, these are the great thoughts and the great teachings which must once again find expression by their respect for those teachings, by their courage to stand for that expression, and by their sincere love for those most precious and wonderful teachings, which will surely illumine the minds of all people. You may think that I am praising too much, but you know, you may judge India by what it is today. But I do not judge India in that way. There is poverty. There is so much misfortune that might exist. But you cannot look on the surface. You must look behind the surface. What is the aspiration and in the heart of the people? And it's not only even the people. It is the soul of the nation which we have to study, which we have to understand. And I believe that it has been a great thing that the East and the West have become conscious of each other. And perhaps the new East will be different and the new West will be different. But we cannot be different unless we are face to face with the problems that exist internationally, nationally, and individually. And if we are face to face, and if we appreciate the true values of life and understand, then we shall discover that within our own hearts is the key to the complete change that can take place in the problems of humanity. And the key exists, which also is the key to the great future filled with the message of spirituality and of peace. And the peace that we want is not merely a peace of an exterior understanding between the minds of people, but an inward peace, a peace with ourselves, a peace with our own conscience, at peace with our own selves, and therefore a far greater and deeper harmony with the rest of the world.
And now Rukmini will give some answers to questions sent up to her from her audience.
You mentioned the brotherhood ideal of all religions. Is the Hindu caste system a negation of this principle? I thought that somebody will ask that question. Actually, the caste system was not a negation of that principle, because it was a system that was a social structure of the country based upon the different types of people with different ways of service to the nation. And each caste had not only its privileges but its duties. The Brahmin was the individual who was the teacher, the administrator, and so on, and that was his duty. And also he had certain ideas. I mean, not only that, there were certain rules. He had to live a particular way of life. He had to sacrifice wealth. A Brahmin was not a person who could earn a living. So a Brahmin was not merely a privileged individual, as you may think. But I can say this, that it had deteriorated into a negation of this principle. And that's one of the reasons why there are many, many Indians who have been working for many years against the breaking up of this sense of superiority. Of course, you can't help it if you are born in a particular caste, because you've got a certain tradition. Because, you know, castes had a tradition of particular particular teaching. For example, Brahmins. Many Brahmins are Sanskrit scholars. Even today, for centuries, they have been perpetuating it. You will find in the same family there will be carpenters. You will find the same family of descendants of the same family becoming sculptors and so on. So there were professions attached to the caste system. But unfortunately, it did deteriorate into a lack of brotherhood. There was the outcast and there was the sense of superiority and inferiority. And I think having deteriorated, time has come for it to disappear, and that's one of the reasons why not only many Indians have worked against it, but actually now, according to law, you know, when it comes to public things like privileges in schools,
colleges or professions, there cannot be any difference
between the castes. It will take a little time for it to completely disappear in the villages, but I am sure when it comes to the younger generation, there will not be any caste system in the next generation. Do you think that the Christian missionaries do any good work in India? Well, I think they have done good work. We must give them their due. They have done good work when it comes to running schools, colleges, and they have done a good deal of work in medical work. They have a marvelous sense of dedication. I wish all the others who believe in others, religions, or not only religions, but other philosophies, would have that same sense of mission as they have. But unfortunately, I wish that, I think that so much what they do has ulterior motive. And that ulterior motive is to convert people. And that, I believe, is an unfortunate thing, because they seem to think that their religion is superior to any other religion, that they are going to save the souls of people. I don't believe in that, and I also think very often the ideas that they teach are much narrower than the ideas that people already have. And it's a pity that from a more comprehensive and wider outlook, people become narrower in their outlook. And they have very strange ideas of Christianity also, which they develop. I know some people who have become Christians who were vegetarians and who believed that eating meat was wrong because you should not live on the lives of other animals and you should not kill. Now that's a great philosophy in India, non-killing. Not that everybody is a vegetarian, but still it's a fundamental belief. Now when they become Christians, they give it up. And very often you hear a Christian, if you say to him, "Are you a vegetarian?" He said, "Oh no, I'm a Christian." As if that has anything to do with Christianity. And they also do other things, like in Christian schools, they seem to have no aesthetic sense whatsoever. That's one of the things in which the missionaries have done great harm, I think, in India, because the taste of the people has deteriorated very much. I don't know why, but they don't seem to have very much aesthetic taste. They make Indian girls wear very strange frocks and cut their hair in strange ways and so on. I don't think that suits them, and that I think is a great pity. And they do harm to others too, even so-called savages. There are certain people called the Nagas. They are hill tribes. They were even headhunters. We might call them savages. But though they may not have our ideas when it comes to very highly cultured religion, still, they are near to nature and they have wonderful sense of color. Now, some of the Christians have converted them to Christianity, and instead of all that beautiful weaving and things which they did, they are crocheting curtains and all kinds of uninteresting things which you can see anywhere in the world. And these are all merely little examples. But I do think that they do dedicated work. If they will only not convert, and if they will only have a little more aesthetic appreciation, they could be much more useful. Will you please give your definition of a cultured person? Well, it's a long thing to say, but I'll try to make it very short. A cultured individual is not only an individual who can appreciate art and who can be sensitive to beauty. A cultured individual, in my opinion, is a sensitive individual. One who is sensitive to the fine points of life, to the finer things of life, who has an inner appreciation of the beauty of both the outer and inner expressions of the divine life. He must be sensitive to the values of life too. In India, when we say culture, when we say Indian culture, we mean art, we mean beauty, we mean a wide outlook, we mean a sensitiveness, a feeling of brotherhood. We consider the philosophy of ahimsa, for example, of harmlessness, of non-injury, of compassion. That is an expression of culture, because the sensitiveness of the individual to higher and lower influences, to ugliness and beauty, to cruelty and brotherhood, these things, this sensitiveness will ultimately lead him to be an individual of rare purity of expression, rare feelings of compassion, of thought, and of philosophy. Now, I don't know whether I have tried to put in what is called a nutshell what I mean by cultured individual. It's only if you are cultured, you can feel how the other person is cultured. And surely, culture is a philosophy as well as an expression and a way of life. Would you say that a moral code could restrict an artist's freedom? Now, I don't understand what you mean by moral code. You mean a moral code laid down by somebody else and saying you must do this and you must not do that? How do we know that my idea of a moral code is necessarily the right one? Surely, the artist is not lacking in his own idea of morality. Now, sense of morality also must be understood. We think if a man gets drunk, he is immoral. Or if he behaves immorally from the point of view of sex and other things, we think that is immoral. I think cruelty is immoral. And there are a large number of people who think cruelty is not immoral. According to me, cruelty to animals is immoral. I would rather see a person drunk than be cruel to an animal. Why? Because by drinking he harms himself. By being cruel he harms somebody else. So you see, our ideas of morality also must be clarified, and not one person can dictate to another.